Hello, I'm Yorick Thayerkov. This is number 0324, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0324. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Dennis Hoff is back. He's the owner of several brothels in Nevada, including the Love Ranch, where former NBA star Lamar Odom was found near death. He shares his side of the story.
Lots of big celebrities come in. Nobody talks about them. But when you OD in my place, guess what? All that's off. Because 5 minutes after he was in the ambulance, I'm getting calls from TMZ. And I know Harvey before TMZ. I'm not going to lie to these people. I'm not going to lie to anybody. When the Today Show calls me and says, Dennis, tell us what's going on. I'm not going to lie to them. I mean, that's where you lose that confidentiality. I'm going to tell the absolute truth because the spin that everybody was putting on it was not good.
David Kaplan and David Gross are the co-founders of Twitter Audit, which verifies your Twitter followers as to whether they're real or not.
There's this big problem on Twitter where you have this like lack of user engagement that you see sometimes for accounts that have a lot of followers. And this is especially important in advertising. So if you can imagine that the whole monetization strategy of Twitter is actually ads. If I'm a company that wants to put ads on or buy kind of ad placements or on Twitter, I want to know that I'm getting, you know, the most bang for my buck and I'm actually spending money where I should be spending money. So it's really important that I know how many active followers a Twitter account has.
Larry Swartz, co-author of This Is a Great Book, Looking to Get Kids to Read. That can be a big challenge.
Well, it's a big challenge, but I think one thing that we have to do is respect the different needs and choices of readers. And I think in schools and in life, we have to offer kids the interests and the choices and the kinds of reading that they want to do and need to do. And when that happens, it's the beginning of a journey to lifelong reading.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff. And, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0324 was Yorick Thayerkov. That's easy enough for him to say. From the website orcasound.com and the owner of Orca Sound Hotel in Rigaud, Quebec. You can check out the websites for both. That's orcasound.com and orcasoundhotel.com. Thank you very much, Yorick, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, alcohol is a tricky thing. You can have just enough and you are the life of the party, engaging in witty repartee, winning friends, and charming the pants off your romantic interest. But too much, and you are breaking into strangers' houses and attempting to breastfeed their children. Yes, just ask Rebecca Silva of South Dakota. After a night of drinking, the 24-year-old apparently broke into a stranger's home and tried to breastfeed a 2-month-old child. The shocked mother was awoken by dogs and called 911. The child's mother was able to safely take her daughter away, but that didn't keep Silva from making herself at home, crawling into bed and passing out. When police arrived, Silva was arrested and charged with unlawful occupancy. She denied the allegations, claiming she never tried to feed the infant and that she had been invited to the home since she had met the mother the night before, which sounds perfectly reasonable if you had 15 beers. Yeah. Has anybody thought, by the way, to give the baby a breathalyzer test? Just asking. Meanwhile, an assistant prosecutor in West Virginia is on indefinite suspension for allegedly pulling a gun in his office over some fake spider Halloween decorations. Logan County Prosecutor John Bennett said Assistant Prosecutor Chris White, who had been with the office for more than 5 years, was suspended in connection with the October 5th incident. Said Bennett, "I never saw it coming, that's for sure. Obviously, I wouldn't have hired him if I had seen it coming." Well, duh. Anyway, he goes on to say, "And the fact that he's been here 5 years and we haven't had any incidents like this also, to me, is a pretty good indication it's certainly out of the ordinary." Okay. Again, Captain Obvious. Bennett said the incident took place after secretaries in the office put up Halloween decorations, including several fake spiders. He said they had spiders every place, and he said he told them it wasn't funny and he couldn't stand them, and he did indeed get a gun out. It had no clip in it, of course. They wouldn't know that. I wouldn't either if I had looked at it, to tell you the truth, Bennett said. He said White only threatened to shoot the spiders and didn't point it at anyone in the office. Bennett goes on to say, again another obvious quote, "Quite naturally, the ladies were concerned, as I would have been. Anybody would be. I think with a gun, no matter where it was," Bennett said. Yeah, again, Captain Obvious. Bennett said he sent out a memo after the incident banning firearms from the office. Again, Captain Obvious. Police said the incident remains under investigation, but no charges are expected at this time. Isn't it kind of sad that you can live in a society where memos have to be sent out banning firearms in the office? You'd think that would be just a given, wouldn't you? Also, is this the worst case of arachnophobia you have ever heard of? Me thinks so too. Anyway, I know people like to collect things, but this story seems a little too weird. For an October report, Vice Media located the half dozen most dedicated collectors of those AOL giveaway CDs from the internet's dial-up years. You remember 50 hours free? Yeah. Sparky Huffle, that's a person's name, wrote a definitive AOL CD collector's guide. Lydia Sloan Klein has 4,000 unique discs. Bustam Halem, that's also another name, believe it or not, at one point had 20,000 total before weeding it down to 3,000. The AOL connoisseurs file discs by color, by the hundreds of packaging styles, by numbers of free hours, and especially by the co-brands, the rare pearls like AOL's deals with Frisbee and Spider-Man. Their collections, say both Halem and Brian Larkin, are simply beautiful. Well, different strokes for different folks, I guess. For the record, I had dozens, maybe hundreds of these discs, but that's because back in the day, on my old radio show, we used to give them away as prizes when we did our computer shows, and the one reason why we had so many of them was a combination of two things: an endless supply and the unwillingness of listeners to accept them. They started piling up around the office like the walnuts in that nightmare dream sequence episode of the old Dick Van Dyke show. Anyway, in a recent resolution, Blount County, Tennessee Commissioner Karen Miller called for her fellow commissioners and state officials all the way up to the governor to prepare for God's wrath for recent policies such as same-sex marriage, etc., that she disagrees with. Though other states might be in for a smiting, Miller's resolution calls on God to spare Blount County by the safety of the Passover lamb. In October, the commission tabled the resolution 10-5, but she promised to reintroduce it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but there is a separation of church and state, right? And judging by the vote, that wingnut was not alone in her thinking. Yikes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, it would be exhaustive to chronicle the many ways that the woman born Carolyn Cray, age 82, of Chattanooga County, Georgia, is different from us. For starters, she was once arrested for stripping nude to protest a quixotic issue before the city council in Rome, Georgia. For another, her driver's license identifies her as Ms. Serpentfoot Serpentfoot. You heard right. In October, she filed to change that name. She wanted to change it to one with 69 words, 68 hyphens, an ellipsis, and the infinity sign. One judge has already turned her down on the grounds that she could not recite the name, though she promised to shorten it on legal papers to No Foot, All Foot, Serpent Foot. Now, I'm not one of those people who automatically dismisses such odd behavior as merely the fact that Ms. Serpentfoot Serpentfoot is 82 years old. I'd be willing to go out on a limb that the soon-to-be No-Foot, All-Foot Serpentfoot was a strange character back in her youth when she was simply Carolyn Cray. Now, she's just putting her best foot forward. Anyway, let's go to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Dennis Hoff is the owner of many brothels in Nevada, including the famed Moonlight Bunny Ranch and the Love Ranch, both near Carson City. We talked to Dennis on several occasions, usually on a lighter note, but this time around, we're discussing the Lamar Odom case, where the former NBA star was found near death in a coma at the Love Ranch back on October 13th. Odom has since been airlifted to Los Angeles, where he is recovering. Dennis is on the line right now from Nevada to bring us up to date on how the story played out at his establishment. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for being on the program with us once again. I have seen you a lot on television over the last little while on several occasions talking about this situation. You certainly have been in the news a lot. Can you bring us up to date as to how this unfolded from your point of view at the Love Ranch near Carson City?
Yeah, there's a million stories. Actually, this is not the Love Ranch Reno Tahoe. It's the Love Ranch Las Vegas, which is 60 minutes from the Strip. Lamar called on the 5th and said he wanted to come out, and then he changed his mind. Then on the 6th, did the same thing. 7th, same thing. 8th, same thing. 9th, same thing. He was partying in Vegas. And on the 10th, he decided to come out. And in the car, he talked to my manager about sad things, about his mother dying, his father being a drug addict, how Chloe was so vindictive, and about his mentor. And so he got there, and one of the things she asked him in the car, she said, I know you've been communicating with Madison Montag, who was our first pre-op transsexual. Are you going to party with him? And Lamar said, well, I want to meet everybody. And when he got there, he met everybody. He picked two girls. And, you know, at the Bunny Ranch, you can spend a few hundred or you can spend a few million, and people have done it all. So they asked him, so what do you want to do, Lamar? How much money do you want to spend? How long do you want to party? I'm going to be here 4 or 5 days. I want to give each one of you $37,500 apiece. I want you at my beck and call 24/7. So the party's on. He's having a great time. Sunday afternoon, early evening, he gets a call. It's about the Kardashian show, and he doesn't like that they played a rerun. It didn't make him look very good. And he was upset for a while, then he got over it. Then he did something real strange. He pulled out a confidentiality agreement. In 23 years, a zillion celebrities, a lot bigger than Lamar, nobody's ever asked for that. And to do it 24 hours after you've been there was real strange to us. So that night was over with. Next day, having a great time. Says, I'm sleeping better than I've ever slept. I love it. When's Dennis going to get here? Wednesday or Thursday? Well, can I extend my stay? Because I want to see Dennis. And, yep, you sure can. And so then Monday night, he says, you know, I just want to have a night by myself. And the girl said, well, okay. I mean, you're paying us $15,000 a day, $7,500 each. But if that's what you want, you're the boss. And then, of course, we run into this terrible tragedy. So I tried to defend Lamar because my staff told him no drugs. He agreed to that. But now it's not looking good. I mean, he's got downers in his system, cocaine in his system, which we knew because he said he was partying in Las Vegas. And he's drinking a bottle of cognac. And that's the celebrity death ride. And sadly enough, it got him.
Okay, so now you said a few moments ago that he had asked for a confidentiality agreement a day after he got there. Did you sign that?
I didn't.
So no one at your establishment signed a confidentiality.
I wasn't there.
Okay. So to your knowledge, did someone in your employ sign a confidentiality agreement?
Oh, all the girls that were around him, yeah.
Okay. Now I'm just wondering because you know there are reports all over the place, and boy, if you go online, you can find all kinds of stuff. So let's clear some of this up right away. You mentioned the two ladies that were with him. Now I understand that's Ryder Cherry and Monica Monroe. Is that correct?
Correct. I just got off the phone with Monica.
Okay. One of the reports talks about the fact that Hollywood Life claims that those two ladies are drug users. Is that accurate or not accurate?
Well, not to my knowledge. If they were drug users, we wouldn't have them there. I mean, we have a strict code. I mean, our place has been there 60 years, 23 years I've owned it. It's all zero tolerance.
Okay, and so it's safe to assume that let's go on the assumption that there's drug life in their past. While in your employ, that's not the case.
Well, I hope not. I mean, but how can you know? You can't watch these people 24 hours a day, just like Lamar promised too. But then all of a sudden, he's got all these drugs in his system. So, you know, it's like who knows? I mean, somebody at your radio station is getting high right now, I promise you.
Well, let me ask you about the overall situation. Now, I saw you on CNN several times, but on one time you were on a Saturday with Michael Smirkanovich, and he brought up an interesting point, the point being that people go to your establishment and there is a certain amount of confidentiality involved in going to an establishment like yours, and that you were out there in the media telling exactly what Lamar had done, how much he had spent. Is that not problematic in your business?
No, not at all, because our business is built on privacy and discretion. Nobody talks about it. Lots of big celebrities come in here. Nobody talks about them. But when you OD in my place, guess what? All that's off. Because 5 minutes after he was in the ambulance, I'm getting calls from TMZ. And I know Harvey before TMZ. I'm not going to lie to these people. I'm not going to lie to anybody. When the Today Show calls me and says, Dennis, tell us what's going on, I'm not going to lie to them. I mean, that's where you lose that confidentiality. I'm going to tell the absolute truth, because the spin that everybody was putting on it was not good. The father was saying, within a few minutes, the father said, those hookers drugged my son. Well, your son's had a problem with drugs for 20 years. I'm sorry. And you have a history, from what I understand, of selling stories, and some of them are untrue, about your son. The Kardashians are making comments. So, you know, I just all that goes out the window when you want to OD in my place.
Okay. Now, I understand, as you just mentioned their name, the Kardashians are not too happy with you. I'm assuming this is not exactly something you're losing sleep over.
Oh, not at all. I mean, the Big Bet Plan, you know, what are they famous for? Because Kim took a page out of the Paris Hilton playbook and had sex with ramped it up one notch by having sex with a rapper. Well, and the mom, Kris Jenner, what's she known for? Her best friend got killed by O.J. Simpson, supposedly. Her ex-husband got him off. Is there anything that these people are famous for? No, they're famous for being famous. And they just put themselves out there, and you talk about media people. I mean, they love the media, and they didn't want me to talk to the Today Show, Good Morning America, because they wanted to do it, and they're not going to protect me. They're not going to tell the truth as I know it. I was protecting Lamar because he promised he wasn't going to do any drugs at my place. But then when I find out that the reports are showing that he's got coke in his system, which could be from when he got there, before he got there, but he's got downers in there also. Well, you know what? That's the problem.
Now, we've talked several times over the years, both on this show and on my previous show, many, many, many years ago. And clearly, your business is going very, very well, has been for a long period of time. Has this incident had any effect, one way or the other, up or down, on business?
Oh, up. Way up. First of all, the downside was I lost two-thirds of the girls that were there. But that's to be expected when they wake up in the morning and there's 28 reporters out in front, a couple satellite trucks. We had to put sheets over the windows because they're filming, trying to film through the windows. It freaks some of them out, especially the ones that want anonymity. And so, yeah, it freaked them out. We've replaced all of those girls. It took 48 hours to move girls from other locations, get them in there. Traffic count is up by 3.
Okay, speaking of all those locations, how many locations do you have? How many girls do you have working?
Well, I have 540 girls licensed with me. I have 7 locations, 3 in southern Nevada. One of them has gone through a multi-million-dollar remodel, and we're probably 4 months from opening back up. In northern Nevada, I have 4 in a strip club and a restaurant, and 3 of them are open. One of them I did a remodel on this year. And we're down to about 97%, just furnishing it and putting photographs on the walls and things like that.
So now that this has happened, this unfortunate incident with Lamar Odom has happened. As you know, celebrities sometimes have a history of partying very heartily. Have you put any measures into place to prevent such a situation from possibly happening again in the future with somebody else?
No, we don't need to. We've had these for 23 years. We don't. There's 25 rock stars could could testify that, hey, Dennis won't let us even smoke weed in this place. We just don't allow it. You know, drugs is not good in the sex business, especially cocaine, because a man can't perform on cocaine. Very few can. And so the girls don't want it because it's just a hassle. The guy's all amped up, and it's their job to make sure they're not doing this stuff. And so, no, I don't know what I would change. In retrospect, what would I do different? You can't have somebody search Lamar Odom. He can hide it. Heidi Fleiss said it best. You know, drug addicts can hide their drugs. Dennis, you know, I did, and I said, yep, you're right. And I did our due diligence. Is he sleeping every night? Yes. Said he had the best night's sleep ever. Great. Then Dr. Drew says, Dennis, that's why we have sleeping pills. I said, okay, Dr. Drew, but how do I know whether he's taking sleeping pills or not? I just assume he's sleeping. Is he eating everything in the kitchen? It seems twice a day we're making runs to Kentucky Fried Chicken, and that 'cause that's what he likes. He's eating good. He's sleeping. It didn't look like he was doing any drugs to me.
Okay. Well, Dennis, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you, for clearing all this up. I'm assuming things are starting to calm down a little bit as far as the media is concerned.
Well, not really. It's always something. You know, they're always unsubstantiated sources. You know, I hate that because that just means some liar or somebody. You know, they go down to a liquor store and get some drunk out in front and say, hey, see this $100 bill? You heard Lamar Odom was doing ABC, right? And tell me. And the guy tells him that, then it's an unsubstantiated source. I mean, that's the way they operate. Wow. The Daily Mail is brutal. National Enquirer is my friends, but they're still good at what they do. And this is a story that's got all the components: hookers, Kardashians, drugs, trannies, NBA superstars, of an outspoken brothel owner. You got a winner. You got a movie.
And it's a script no one would ever believe. Dennis, thank you very, very much for being on the program with us once again.
Always great, Peter. Bye-bye.
Dennis Hoff, the owner of the Moonlight Bunny Ranch and the Love Ranch, to name just two of the brothels he runs in Nevada. You can also visit my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0324, and you'll find links to Dennis's site.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about Twitter audit, find out who has real Twitter followers and who has fake ones. Plus, we'll discuss teaching children to appreciate reading with Larry Swartz, the author or co-author of This Is a Great Book. But right now, we still have more Stuff File news right here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Oh, yes, we also do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on. Stick around for that. 34-year-old Stephen Felton from Pennsylvania went on trial after a string of robberies, most of which were recorded by security cameras, which showed his face clearly. He was caught because he used his own car as a getaway vehicle. Representing himself in his trial, Felton yelled out bizarre objections to the evidence against him, such as freedom of speech and unfair prejudice. His defense, his evil twin did the robberies. Clearly, he's watched a lot of soap operas in the past. The jury only took 4 hours to convict him of 10 counts of robbery and 2 counts of theft, but the judge rolled her eyes that they took that long. It would have taken me as long as the time it takes to write the word guilty on a page, said Lehigh County Judge Kelly L. Banash. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that you are the perpetrator. When she sentenced Felton to 62 to 124 years in prison, he didn't say a word. Huh? I would have bet on legal malpractice was something he would have shouted out, but I guess he didn't. Now that I think about it, by the way, why did the jury take so long? What exactly was their debate here? I don't know. Police in Idaho Falls, Idaho, say an Oregon man accidentally dialed 911 while making an alleged drug deal that was overheard by dispatchers. LaJuan Saunders of Portland is accused of several drug-related charges stemming from the September 27th incident. Court records show dispatchers overheard three men talking about selling drugs. They triangulated the call, and officers arrived at the location to find three men standing by a car. Police found marijuana on one of the men. Officers also reportedly found pot inside the car. Two men from Shelley, Idaho, said Saunders told them he would sell the marijuana at a hotel where he and his girlfriend were staying. Police got a search warrant for that hotel room and found marijuana and other drugs. Saunders and his girlfriend, Charity Fournier, were booked into Bonneville County Jail. Well, butt dialing can be such an inconvenience in one's day. Here's an idea. While committing a crime, folks, why don't you just turn your phone off? Yeah. Moving right along, 68-year-old Hinton Sharon, on trial in England's Plymouth Crown Court in September, denied that he was the indecent exposer, charged with 18 incidents against children dating back to 1973. That he would never do such a thing because he would not want anyone to see his unusually small penis. In response, the prosecutor brought in a prostitute known to have served Sharon to testify that his penis is of normal size. Sharon was convicted and sentenced to 17 years in prison. Okay, wouldn't you expect a court of law to bring in a doctor as opposed to a prostitute to determine normal penis size? Anyway, no matter how you look at it, even in court, size matters. Especially if you're lying. A Jacksonville, Florida sheriff's SWAT team surrounded a mobile home on October 14th to arrest 34-year-old Ryan Bautista and 30-year-old Leanne Hun on armed burglary and other charges, but since two other women were being held inside, officers remained in a standoff. Hun subsequently announced by phone that the couple would surrender after having sex one final time. Deputies entered the home around 4 a.m. on the 15th and made the post-coital arrest without incident. Boy, that brings new meaning to one for the road, doesn't it? And by the way, did the two hostages just have to sit there and watch? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we've got three quick short stories that all come under the headline of Weird Norway. We already told you about the first one a little while back, but it bears repeating. The first one being Norway's notorious 77 murder terrorist, Anders Breivik, who is now serving only 21 years because that is Norway's maximum sentence, complained in September that he was feeling so oppressed behind bars that if conditions didn't improve, he would go on a hunger strike and starve himself. To which I say, go right ahead. Number two, in July, artist Hilde Krohn Hughes, shooting a video alone in a forest near Accra, accidentally got hung upside down naked in a tree for nearly 4 hours. It would be extremely funny and hard to explain if she were found there by hunters. They'd probably think it was some sort of odd kind of bait. And speaking of hunters, in October, hunters who had shot two elk near Narvik were informed that they had inadvertently wandered into an area of the Polar Park Zoo and that, thanks to them, the zoo's elk population was now down to 3. Yes, hunting's always easier when you do it at a zoo. Anyway, let's get to our next guest, shall we? A recent article in the Montreal Gazette brought to light the Twitter account of Montreal Mayor Denis Coderre, namely the fact that many of his Twitter followers are fake. In the story, we learned about a company called Twitter Audit that verifies the validity of Twitter followers. It's the brainchild of two Montrealers, David Kaplan and David Gross, and both are on the line with us right now from New York via Skype to talk about Twitter Audit. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us. First of all, why is it important to authenticate Twitter users? I know it's an obvious question, but I'll let you answer that.
So, yeah, there's actually a lot of reasons. So you mean Twitter followers?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so basically, the main reason, the reason that we got into it was because we saw that we knew some people, we heard of people that were buying followers, and we you know, it's kind of a side project, and we wanted to see if we can kind of come up with a way to just, like, with an algorithm or some code, figure out if they are buying followers.
And, like, accurately, so.
Yeah, and the other reason that we kind of fell into was actually that there's this big problem on Twitter where you have this, like, lack of user engagement that you see sometimes for accounts that have a lot of followers. So, and this is especially important in advertising. So if you can imagine that the whole monetization strategy of Twitter is actually ads. If I'm a company that wants to kind of put ads on or buy kind of ad placements or on Twitter, I want to know that I'm getting, you know, the most bang for my buck, and I'm actually, you know, spending money where I should be spending money. So it's really important that I know how many active followers a Twitter account has.
Okay, so how does one find out whether you have active followers? For instance, I read the story that was in the Gazette, and I saw your website, so I went to it, and I put in my own Twitter account and realized that I have 86%, an 86% score, which means that, 14% of my followers are fake.
So, yeah, there is a decent margin of error. So Twitter Audit, there's a bunch of tools like it online. I would say that Twitter Audit might be the most kind of aggressive tool in that we label followers as fake, even though they might actually be inactive. And so kind of sometimes, honestly, it's hard to tell the difference. But basically, the way Twitter Audit works is it looks at 5,000 followers, and they're essentially random. And so it's a large sample size. And what we then do is we go look at all those user accounts, and we take a look at a few factors. So we say, you know, did they update their profile picture? Do they change the kind of profile colors on their account? Do they tweet often? When was the last time they tweeted? Do they have favorites? Do they have lists? How many? What's the ratio of followers to friends? So how many people do they follow compared to how many people follow them? Then we look at the content of the tweets. Sometimes you see a lot of repetitive content if it's like a spam bot or something like that. And that's basically it. We look at a bunch of other things, and we basically kind of make a score, and then we kind of have a cutoff, and we then use that as like a guesstimate kind of whether we think the follower is fake.
Now, so, sorry, go ahead.
A score of 86 is actually very high. I'd say that's like above average. It's above the average of Twitter, so that's why your thing's green. It's more, for you, it'd be an indication, not that you bought followers, but that some of the people, 14% of the followers that we audited, look like they're inactive. So that means 14% of your user base is like not engaged, probably, or they would never be engaged because they're not on Twitter regularly.
That's what I was about to ask. It's not like I didn't go out and buy followers. I'm not even interested in that. But I do have, obviously, 14% who are apparently not real. So is it possible to have an even higher score? I mean, can you control who your so-called followers are?
No, I think everybody will have some percentage. I mean, unless you have a very low follower base, like if you're in like under 100 or under 500, then you could be at 100% probably. But that's just because it's probably people you know that are on Twitter. They told you to come and follow you, and they're on there regularly. But most people will have some sort of percentage of inactive. When it's in green, we're claiming that you probably did not buy anything. It's if it's a percentage of what we say is like inactive, it means that they're just not on there regularly. You're not fraudulently going out and buying followers. Like, we originally made this to say that there's all these people claiming to be social media experts, and we wanted to say, hey, you know, like these guys that are saying they're social media experts, a lot of these guys are buying their followers. They'll have millions of followers or hundreds of thousands of followers, and 0% of them are coming back real. These guys are buying them and then going around saying, oh, I'll do consulting services. I'll tell you how to be really good on social media, but they themselves weren't that good, but they look like they were because tools like this didn't exist then. So they were able to go out and sell their services and kind of be fake. But for you, with that kind of a score, you'd say, no, none of those are fake. They're actually just people who signed up to Twitter, followed you, and never came back really to do anything interesting. Or there could be a few bots, but that's probably not your fault. It's probably just random bots trying to follow you.
Okay,
but,
now,
when you're in the red zone is when you're looking like somebody who's going out and buying. If you're in the under 40%,
right?
It's red. We say it's red because we believe you're probably going out and buying, because that's just too large of a number to be accidentally or people not being active on your system. It's just too crazy a number.
Now, can we really can we really underplay those who are inactive? And the reason why I say that, I do know people on Twitter who go on Twitter because they like to follow people and see the links that these people talk about. It's either news stories or news organizations, maybe celebrities, but they don't themselves tweet. Wouldn't they be considered inactive?
Yeah, so that's kind of where the margin of error is. I think that there are a lot of users, but you know, the algorithm is like sensitive enough so that like maybe if they even favorite some things or if they like some, you can tell that something's a bot. Like oftentimes if someone follows like 10,000 users and they don't have any followers at all.
And zero tweets.
You know, and they don't, you know, that's like a big difference between someone who maybe follows like 20 or 30 or 40 people and it's just, maybe they even have like a couple followers. Like even most people who are like actual humans probably will have a couple followers.
Okay, so when you guys came up with this idea, and you say there are other companies out there that do what you guys do, you were basically going after the people who are making claims that they have millions of followers and possibly profiting from that idea.
Yeah. Because there was these ad networks to begin with in the early days of Twitter, or when people really started to ramp up the user base on Twitter, that were selling tweets. So you could go to Snoop Doggy Dog and have Snoop Dogg tweet something about a product you're selling. And these guys that were selling tweets, they were selling it based on your followers, but there was no way for them to say, hey, like Snoop Doggy Dog has 2 million, 3 million followers. What am I really paying for? Am I paying for the full 3 million, or do I want to figure out a way to see what is the value of each tweet that Snoop Doggy Dogg is going to be putting out there? And we were able to offer kind of a service to these people to say, hey, audit these guys and see if there's people you want to have on your network. Because like I said before, if you're the kind of person that says you're a social media expert and you go to this website that sells tweets and you're on their network and you say you have 500,000 users that are following you, but 500,000 of them are fake, you're in essence fraudulent. It's like a fraudulent transaction. You're paying for nothing. So that's sort of how we went after that kind of stuff.
What about the other side of the coin? People who will follow you for the expressed interest of you following them, even if they're celebrities. I'll give you an example. There's a lot of talk nowadays about the actor Taye Diggs. He has a lot of followers online, but he gets a lot of those followers, and I was one of the people who went along with it. Suddenly he's following me. So I was like, okay, why is Taye Diggs following me? So I followed him. And then I find out stories later on that, well, not necessarily he does, but his representatives. Because a lot of times, celebrities don't even tweet for themselves.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I think pretty much every big name on Twitter has a PR department or a social media department, that people that are just managing it. I think it's a full-time job to do it well. And so it's oftentimes easier just to outsource it. I think just from the email and feedback I've gotten and people contacting us for help, is a lot of the time it's actually the social media companies. The social media management companies that will actually take the initiative to actually buy the fake followers in the first place.
Yeah.
And oftentimes I get an email from someone saying, hey, like I need help. Like this, I hired a company or a person to help me with my social media. They bought 100,000 followers and now my score is really bad. You know, and so we see that a lot, actually, and they want to know how to clean it up. And so, you know, sometimes we help them clean up their fake followers. And
so are you saying then that it's possible some people are buying so-called fake followers or followers not realizing that they're fake?
It's possible. Yeah,
especially when you're not managing yourself. I mean, I think that's a big thing for us, is that if you are hiring these kind of social media experts, like these consultants in essence, you should kind of quickly just use a tool like this or any of the other ones to just say, hey, is this guy really an expert at this? And is he good at getting engagement? And I think that's the big thing on Twitter, is you want engagement. You don't just want a big number. You want people actually engaging in your content and buying the products you're suggesting and listening to the things you have to say. And this tool allows you to quickly just say, hey, does this guy have any engagement at all? And then you can make a hire or not hire decision based on that kind of information.
So one last question. How well are you guys doing with the breaking of this story in the Montreal Gazette? Are your Twitter followers increasing in a real way?
I think we get a lot of traffic whenever there's like a big news story. And it's, you know, a lot of the buzz typically comes around politicians in all over the world. I mean, we have like the Philippines and South America and just everywhere.
Yeah, the Middle East.
You know, whenever there's elections, there's always a lot of like Twitter fraud articles and, you know, all the time. It's pretty incredible.
I guess bottom line is buyer beware and don't pay too much attention to how many followers somebody has realistically, or definitely use a service like yours, Twitter Audit, correct?
Exactly.
David and David, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, much appreciated.
David Kaplan and David Gross, the co-founders of Twitter Audit. You can visit my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0324, and you'll find the links to their site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. One of the most amazing inventions I've ever seen is a table saw that stops the blade instantly when it comes into contact with skin. Saws like these could prevent thousands of injuries, but it's hard to find them in stores. And one big reason is a fear of lawsuits. Many retailers are worried that if the blade doesn't stop every time and someone is injured, they'll be sued. Unfortunately, selling ordinary table saws doesn't protect them from lawsuits either. In Alabama, a man recently sued a retailer after injuring himself on the type of table saw that's been used by carpenters for decades. Even though that saw is safe when used properly, he claimed it was defective just because it didn't have the expensive blade-stopping technology. Let's be fair, safety innovations like this should be applauded. But saying a saw is defective because it cuts is like saying a candle is defective because it burns. That's nonsense, and this kind of lawsuit abuse is piling costs on consumers. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
You're listening to the Stuff File program. It's the choice of 4 out of 5 dentists. The 5th dentist also listens, but that's just because he follows the crowd. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about kids and reading. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. But I got one more Stuff File news story to share with you before we get to our next guest. Authorities say a burglar who broke into a middle school got stuck in an elevator and was forced to call 911 for help. Police say 19-year-old Michael Claude of Laurel broke into the school. Officials say he was riding down the hallways on a buffing machine before he got on the elevator. After he got stuck, police say Claude called 911 for help, and an elevator maintenance service was able to open the doors. Police say Claude was found wearing a Laurel Letterman jacket that did not belong to him. He was charged with third-degree burglary, criminal mischief, and theft, and he was released on $3,800 bond. You know, when you misbehave in a school, you usually end up with a detention. That's what I hear, anyway. Yeah, that's it. Anyway, let's get to our next guest. Speaking of school, shall we? Larry Swartz is the co-author of This is a Great Book, which champions the belief that having a wide range of great books is essential to students becoming readers, both inside the classroom and beyond. Larry's on the line with us right now from Toronto to talk about how to accomplish just that. Hi, Larry.
Hi there. How are you today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. So how does one go about accomplishing that?
Well, it's a big challenge, but I think one thing that we have to do is respect the different needs and choices of readers. And I think in schools and in life, we have to offer kids the interests and the choices and the kinds of reading that they want to do and need to do. And when that happens, it's the beginning of a journey to lifelong reading.
Now, was there some sort of aha moment when you decided this is a book that needs to be written? Was there a moment when push came to shove and you said, I got to get this word out?
Well, I'm passionate about children's literature. That's been my career as an educator. and I work with beginning teachers, and I speak to parents. And we're in the 21st century where there's all kinds of reading happening, and we have to broaden our understanding of text that students are encountering, and certainly social media. So I don't want to lose that children's literature love. That's been part of my life, and it's been part of many, you know, the librarian world, the parents' world, and what makes a good reader. We tend to judge reading by the novels they read, the size of the books, but I respect that there's all kinds of reading happening in kids' lives, and once we understand that, we can move forward. But I still have a very strong belief, and my aha moment is, let's not give up on the great, great books that are out there, particularly in the Canadian children's book industry.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I think you may have just answered my next question, and that is, what is it you think we're doing wrong?
I don't want to blame teachers, and I don't want to challenge teachers. Actually, we do want to challenge teachers, and that's one thing that the book does, is to look at how they present literature two students in the classroom. Now, most of this experience is grades 3 to 9, and I think that reading can live in our classrooms and reading can die in our classrooms. So I think the way that we present literature in our programs, and teachers have curriculum expectations and ways that they have their own beliefs in teaching reading, but I'm just fearful that we are not giving them a balance that respects his choices. I'm going to stress that choice is one of the number one components to making a great reader. And in our system, we want to look at building independent readers. And I'm nervous about teachers who only do the whole class novel, and there's pros and cons. You've got 30 kids in the class, and they're all reading the same novel. We can weigh the pros and cons to that, which we outline in the book. And I love the community read, but that reading is still, that way of reading and teaching is one of the most predominant ways, and it's also the least effective to build readers. I think our goal is to build better readers and encourage them to move onwards for their tastes and interests. So I'm nervous about the way it's taught in the classroom, and all I'm inviting is a balance. So we move to independent reading, do have some structured community, whole class novels, and especially small group reading where kids can gather together and talk about the books they read.
Now, did you say ages 3 to 9 or grades 3 to 9?
Grades 3 to 9.
Okay.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Okay. The reason why I bring
the center of this book is novels. So we, from chapter books to young adolescent literature. So we're looking at fiction in particular, and we are looking at novels in this book.
That's an interesting range of ages and grades. Because I only think back to when I was in that range myself. I remember as a young child how much I loved reading Charlotte's Web.
And did you read that book by yourself?
No, this was something.
That one comes up on any list when I talk about what books do you remember from your past, and 90% of the time it's a teacher read aloud. So how kids get these books is something to, you know, are they reading it aloud? Are they reading in groups? Are they choosing the book on their own? But when we look at the continuum, the chapter books, if you go to any bookstore, you'll see shelves and shelves of series books where the kids are moving from picture books into reading series book. They're called chapter books, and so you get your Junie P. Jones, and you get the Time Warp Trio is a great book, a series as well, and the Magic Treehouse. So kids develop their tastes and interests, and now when we talk about the 9 to 12-year-old, I call them the quantity years because they are developing their taste and interest. They're finding an author that they really like. They're finding a genre that they really like. And another big thing is they're influenced by their peers. What are their friends reading?
Now, again, I remember when I was that age, I loved reading Charlotte's Web. And that was a book that the class read collectively. It wasn't the one that the teacher read to us. But I also remember in high school not enjoying reading as much.
Well, that's a whole other issue, because traditionally, you can name the 5 novels that are taught in high school. You know that they're going to do To Kill a Mockingbird. You know they're going to do Lord of the Flies, and hopefully they bring in Canadiana. But there's not much choice in the way that the novels are, the kids read novels. So we tend to lose, how many adolescents choose to read independently on their own, and we're looking at males and females, and the statistics tell us that boys don't choose to read novels, It's not that boys don't read novels, and it's not that men don't read novels. But statistically, we're not talking about the boys. But certainly there's genres that appeal to them. The graphic novel industry has exploded, and the fantasy novel. I mean, Harry Potter revolutionized the world. So there are certain kinds of books, like The Hunger Games, which moves into fantasy, that adolescents will read. But in our classrooms, the schools, I think we're still at a traditional model for the most part. And I think that hasn't done favor to building better readers. But as I say, we're just talking about one kind of reading now, fiction reading.
How much of a role do parents play in this? And again, I bring up my own reading as a child. I remember as a kid, I couldn't get a new Hardy Boys book fast enough.
Amazing. And I think if kids have to see their parents as readers, I know it's a challenge for many families, especially, you know, we've got different age groups in the household, perhaps. But I think one thing is that parents have to, you know, buying books can be expensive, but offering them what a bookstore offers, certainly libraries, school libraries, finding out what's in the classroom, and actually just taking an interest in what their kids are reading. So I think if the parent has a passion about that or an interest in it, that serves as a model for what kids might do, and they see the adults in their lives. We've got the teacher, we've got librarians, but parents play a very significant role if they are concerned about building their child as readers.
When it comes to books in school, should teachers be doing something different other than the standard book report?
Well, I think the choosing books is one thing. So organizing their classroom is something that we talked about. And what books are they offering? Because there's some great books to choose from that deal with many universal themes. And then what do we do with the book? So the response. Traditionally, the book report, perhaps has killed reading. I had painful experiences with the book report for my grade 7, 8, and 9 years. But I think we've got to find creative ways. This one has never failed me. When the students become a character in the novel and pretend that character writes a diary or a letter. And I love that because it builds empathy and they retell the story and they're building their own connections. And of course, I want activities that invite kids to use technology to share their enthusiasms about a book. And that sharing can promote reading with their friends as well. So I'm looking at all the spectrum. We want kids to talk about books, write about books. And I'm an arts-based person, so I want them to do drama and respond visually. So I think giving them that spectrum of choice rather than the traditional, I don't know what your experience were, it was question and answer after the chapters. And that goes back to how I was taught. And I think that is not the most meaningful way to teach.
You just mentioned writing a diary or a story in the form of the character. All I kept thinking when you said that is, I got goosebumps thinking, where were you when I was in school?
Well, I was probably teaching your brothers and sisters. But I think it's a great one because it's never failed me. Because the length doesn't matter, but I think it's stepping into the shoes of the characters. And hooray, we're making connections. How am I like this character? What does this character tell me? Looking at issues and problems. And that's the big picture, too. Why do we want kids to read novels? I think with novels, we can bring the whole world in our classroom and we can take our kids to the whole world. And we really want, what has this reading taught me and how has it built me as a reader?
From your reader's point of view, who is your book written for? Is it written for teachers? Is it written for parents? Or is it something even the students themselves can take a look at and think about what they're using or how they're using their reading skills as a learning tool?
The framework is for a school program, so it is for educators. But the activities were written to the voice of the students, so we invite them, imagine that you were the character, and imagine you were going to make a movie of this. So in that respect, the activities are designed for the students. And, of course, we have a very extensive book. Shelley and I have read thousands of books to come up with what we thought were great books. And so those book lists are very supportive when parents ask, what should I read with my kid? And we've done it developmentally from chapter books for older and to older readers.
And you mentioned Shelley. That's the co-writer you wrote with. That's
Shelley Stagg Peterson. Shelley Stagg Peterson's my colleague, and she's a book expert.
Excellent. The book, again, is called This Is a Great Book. It's a great title.
We thought we'd give the review right in the title.
This Is a Great Book, written by Larry Swartz and Kelly Stagg Peterson. Larry, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Larry Swartz, co-author, along with Shelley Stagg Peterson, of This Is a Great Book. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0324, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
25-year-old Jorge Vasconcelos was traffic stopped in El Reno, Oklahoma in October because he was reportedly weaving on the road, but deputies detected no impairment except possibly for a lack of sleep. Then, out of nowhere, Vasconcelos, instead of quietly driving off, insisted that he was doing nothing wrong and that deputies could check his truck if they thought otherwise. They did, and found an elaborately rigged metal box in the engine containing 17 pounds of heroin worth over $3 million. He was charged with aggravated trafficking. Oh, man. Why? Oh, why? After getting stopped by police and released, you belabor the issue of your innocence by daring the cops to check your truck when you know you're carrying over $3 million worth of heroin? Well, one reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0324. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0324. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.